All right, Jeremiah 37 and 38. And so, if you recall, what we had talked about is the Babylonians came down, Nebuchadnezzar's army came down, and they surrounded Jerusalem. But then there was a distraction with the Egyptian forces coming up, and so there was a little bit of a reprieve. And so the armies of the Babylonians are pulled away for a moment. And then Jeremiah takes that opportunity to go out of the city down towards Benjamin to see about some land. And while he's down there, they accuse him of defecting, going to over to the enemies. And of course, some of the things that he said might lead people to think that that would be a possibility. But they nevertheless, they arrest him. And so as he's brought back, he's thrown into prison. And there are a great many men who want to kill them. And a couple of you made note of who some of those men were. There's one man in particular that has some relation to someone else that Jeremiah has had some interaction with. Does anybody know who that is of the nobles who want to kill Jeremiah? Anybody remember that? Let's see. Where's the people that mentioned that to me? No. All right. Remember the prophet that Jeremiah butted heads with, Hananiah, who ends up his grandson. It looks like in the looking at the genealogies of these, the brief genealogies of these noblemen, one of his grandsons is one of the ones saying, "Let's kill Jeremiah." So you could imagine where his motivations might come from after what happened to his grandfather. So that's something interesting to add to the mix. So they're wanting to kill Jeremiah. And so we've got the defection for the reason for the arrest. Why do they want to kill him? Yeah. And particularly, what do they think of his message? I mean, what is it? How do they describe it? Yeah. I mean, what is he preaching? We've talked about it. What's the message?
Surrender.
No one's ever going to be popular who preaches surrender. All right. You know, one of the things I think that's difficult for us in relating to the Jewish people, to the Israelites, is our church and state are very separated. And so when we preach moral messages, there's not a whole lot of political application for us. We're separated somewhat from the political. And I think we're supposed to be somewhat separated from the political. But it is completely intermingled. And so God's message is surrender, and that's a political as well as religious message. And really, for the Israelites, the problem is when they've separated the political from the religious. They were supposed to be in harmony. And here are people who are probably taking that more politically than they are religiously, and unfortunately, they ought to be combining those and recognizing that God's rule is government rule. I mean, God's rule is not just, it's, you don't separate that and worship's here and political decisions are there. No, they're all intertwined. And so, God is giving them advice giving them instruction, direction that, politically is never going to be popular. If enemies are at the gates today and somebody's preaching the kind of message that Jeremiah's preaching, what would we call that person?
Traitor.
We'd call him a traitor. And so again, what do we do with traitors? Yep. The death penalty is still on the table for traitors. You know that? That even now, I mean, we probably would hardly ever do it because it's a political hot button, but even now, if someone is a traitor to this country, the death penalty is what that is such a high crime. So I just want you to understand these are not just crazy people. This is a mentality I think any of us could get into, that we could point at somebody and say, "How dare you? How could you possibly say something like that?" A message of surrender. And so that's why they want to kill them. Why was his life spared? He's thrown down into the cistern, to the pit. He's sinking in the mire. There's no food. Who comes to his rescue? Yeah. Or the Ethiopian eunuch, we might say. I like to refer to him as that just because, I think that taking that description and planting that description in our minds helps us when we get to Acts chapter 8 to remember that that was the description of somebody else, right? So the Ethiopian eunuch comes, and he is the one who pleads for the rescue. Where's Zedekiah in all this? Right. But with regards to the wanting to kill Jeremiah, with wanting to save Jeremiah, what's Zedekiah's role in all of that? Yeah. We want to kill Jeremiah. Okay. We want to save Jeremiah. Okay. He just seems to have no backbone. And no willingness to take a convicted stand and say, we're going to do this, this is the right thing, etc. And so Zedekiah is a very weak, weak king. And I think that's, we look at people like that. They're all through the scriptures and they're all through political history. As I was reading a biography of Winston Churchill several years ago, and it was comparing him to his predecessor, and it said that Winston Churchill had a compass and his predecessor had a weather vane. And so it's the idea of figuring out where political opinion is and going in that direction versus figuring out what's right and wrong and going in that direction. And so Zedekiah certainly falls into that long line of weak politicians. I think Trevor and I were talking about it. It seems a lot like Pilate, who just, I'd like to do good for you. I wish I could save you. But in the end, he's not going to take a stand. He's not going to take the heat that comes from taking a stand. Tony mentioned that during this time, Zedekiah is going to Jeremiah to get information. How does he approach Jeremiah? What is the approach that he takes when he comes and asks for these prophecies? Secretly? And what does he tell Jeremiah? Don't tell anybody we had this conversation. What else? When Jeremiah's reluctant on occasion to respond, what does Zedekiah tell him? Oh, I don't care. I'll listen. I'll listen to whatever you say. Whatever God says. And then when Jeremiah gives him the same thing he's really been saying the whole time, what is Zedekiah's response? Yeah, well, not that. And just let me just say that there are a lot of people that will talk that talk. I'll do whatever God says. This is what God says. Well, I mean, I'll do anything else God says other than that. And so really what you've proven is you won't do whatever God says. You'll do what God says so long as it's what you wanted to do in the first place. And that's what Zedekiah, we talked about that already. Zedekiah wants God to say that he's going to deliver them like he's delivered them in the past. But that's not happening. That's not on the table. That's not one of the options. What's one of the options is I can make it less bad than it has to be. And so he can reduce the severity, but he can't take it away altogether. And I think that's what happens sometimes is when we have an opportunity to reduce the severity, we're not happy with that. We want consequences gone completely. And as I say, that's not an option. Right. 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 Well, it's like Balaam even, who says, look, these are the words I got. They're the only ones I can say. And he even wanted to say something different than God's word. So, yeah. All right. With regards to Zedekiah, we have two prophecies particularly that we want to look at that are made regarding him. And that might, before they come to pass, might be difficult to reconcile. And so what are those two prophecies? He'd see Nebuchadnezzar face to face and, but you won't see Babylon. You'll be taken away to Babylon, but you won't see Babylon. All right. And so, that might seem enigmatic, at the front end. Say, well, how's that work? I'm going to be taken to see Nebuchadnezzar. I'm going to go to Babylon, but not see it. And so it could be confusing and it's rather morbid when we get to the fulfillment of both of those prophecies. But it is interesting to me that the prophecies are given, and they're given in that sort of way that might confuse. What might that do for someone who didn't want to believe what the prophets were saying? Do what? Yeah. It gives you an opportunity to buy into the lie and to not believe, to reject. Brad? Right. Yeah. And so you can misapply or mistake. Or if it's just difficult, you can say, there's no way you can harmonize the, you know, instead of trying to think through that and say, and it, you know, sometimes when we're harmonizing the scriptures, people will go, well, you really had to work on that one. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you do have to work to harmonize two ideas. And you would have to work to harmonize these two ideas. They do harmonize in the end. Right. Kevin? Right. There's room for it. Yeah. Yes. And as Brad pointed out, and we'll be talking about that in the lesson this morning, Jesus spoke in such a way, or rather, Michael pointed out, Jesus spoke in such a way so as to specifically leave that opportunity. You don't want to believe this? I'm not going to force you. Chris? Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, we'll come in our next lesson. We'll be coming to the resolution of those two prophecies, the reconciliation of them. And so, let's come on into the next lesson, lesson 9, the fall of Jerusalem and the aftermath of the fall. And we'll look at that. And then we'll be, after this lesson, we'll be moving on into the period of captivity, or at least more focused on the period of captivity. Well, when Babylon came to the gates of the city and set up their siege, and this is the final siege. How long did that siege last? We have a couple of time markers that help us out there. About a year and a half, all right? Because we're told the year and the month of the reign of Zedekiah. And what prompted them to come down in the first place? Yeah, he thought Egypt was going to help him out, right? And so he, like so many other kings, wanted to use one nation against another, and it didn't work out very well. As you read through the prophets, it is interesting to see how frequently it will come up that somehow Israel is relying on Egypt. And what's the historical irony of that? Yeah, and Egypt's the original oppressors. They're the original they're the original ones who put them into bondage and captivity, and they went away from there, and Egypt is used in so many ways as an illustration of what you want no part of, and yet the prophets will bring, why do you go back trusting in Egypt? And there's a lot of different ways that it talks about, you know, you're leaning on a broken reed, there's a lot of different ways that it's portrayed the folly, of leaning on Egypt. And so here again, the folly is illustrated. Well, it tells us in the ninth year and I think the tenth month of Zedekiah's reign that they came to the gates, and then they breached the gates on the 11th year and the fourth month. And so that will give us the year and a half, roughly, that it took to breach the walls. And when they did breach the walls, what was Zedekiah's reaction to flee? Even then, when the walls were breached, he didn't see it and give in. But let me just back up for just a moment. Babylon comes down and they come to the gates. They're here. Jeremiah's been preaching a message this whole time, preparing them for that moment. And they don't take advantage of the moment. They get a reprieve. Babylon goes away for a time, and now they can think it over. And can reconsider and listen further to what Jeremiah's still preaching the same message. And he's the prophet that's proven himself. Now they come back and they get a year and a half to think about Jeremiah's message. As much as we're looking at the judgment of God, don't overlook the mercy of God in all of this. How much time and opportunity did God give them? It wasn't at the blink of an eye. It wasn't as a woman's labor pains come upon her. It was, here it is, I'm going to let that sink in for a year and a half and give you all that opportunity to finally respond and do what Jeremiah said. Don't do it. And so I want us to see that. I want us to understand that, because we are thinking in terms of judgment, and it could be very easy for us to overlook God's mercy in that judgment, that he is giving them so many opportunities. But like we said before, maybe they look at the Babylonians going away for a time. You know, they could, instead of interpreting that as opportunity to respond correctly, they could look at it as, see, you know, they're going back away and they'll go away this time. And so you could harden your heart just as easily to the mercy of God. And I think that that's what they did. Well, they breached the walls and Zedekiah and some of his soldiers, they flee and they head down towards the river. And what happens at that point? Do they get away? No, they're cut off at the pass, as it were. And then they bring him to who? Do what? Nebuchadnezzar. They bring him to Nebuchadnezzar. There's prophecy one fulfilled. He saw him. Then what does Nebuchadnezzar do? Yeah, he brings his children, his sons before him and slays them before his eyes. And then what does he do? Puts his eyes out and takes him to Babylon. There's prophecy two fulfilled. And so, can you imagine if what's going through Zedekiah's mind when those prophecies are revealed, that doesn't even make sense. And the horror of realizing how much sense it makes when it actually happens. And I think that there are a lot of people like that. When they hear of the judgment of God, they say, that doesn't even make sense. And the horror of the recognition of seeing, oh, it does. And now I see it all. And so it's sobering, and it ought to be sobering to us. Well, Jeremiah is still in Babylon, or rather Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar gives his officer instructions, and he goes to Jeremiah, and what's the offer he makes him? And what sort of a life would he have lived in Babylon based on the offer? Comfortable. And so more comfortable than anything he's been living in Jerusalem, that's for sure. And certainly more comfortable than anything he's going to be living in Jerusalem as it goes forward. Even the prospect of it. It's not like Jeremiah's looking around and going, well, now that things are over, we can rebuild. No, that is Jeremiah thinking in terms of things are going to be okay in Jerusalem now, and so I might as well stay here because it's going to be comfortable. Is that his thought process? That's right. That's right. Why does he stay? Yeah. 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 So that is one thing. He is torn. But what's the tear? I mean, is it a hard decision in our minds? There's people of God that are still there. And they need somebody. And they need some guidance. And he doesn't want to leave them without that. And so he will not put down his job even now. Even after really the main thrust of his job is over. It was to warn these people. They didn't listen. It's done. The city is destroyed. And his message has not gotten across. At least he could have some nice retirement. And he won't. And he continues to be the guide, to be the preacher of God's truth to this people. And so he stays there in Jerusalem. And what's the state of Jerusalem? Yes. Trevor? Right. Right. And as we go along, we'll think about that idea of there's no hope for these people. I think there was. Even now. That there was an option. There were choices to make. And so at any rate, Jeremiah hopes to stay and guide them through that. What is the state of Jerusalem? Utterly destroyed. It's so utterly destroyed that when the next governor is put in place, there's nothing, there's nowhere to set up shop there. They have to go to Mizpah. They got to go somewhere else because you can't rule from a place that is, as the prophecies had suggested, scraped clean. There's just nothing there. There's nothing to build on. And so they go over to Mizpah. So they go over to Mizpah, and we'll come to that and Gedaliah in just a moment. But look over at 2 Chronicles 36. In 2 Chronicles 36, as we are concluding there the Chronicles account and being taken into captivity, what does it tell us are the reasons for the being taken into captivity? Okay, and so one aspect is because of how they treated the messengers of God. What does that echo for us moving forward into the New Testament. Yeah, that's what, it's the very thing Jesus pointed to the Pharisees. You know, he says, you're just like your fathers. You've rejected over and over. He lists out the prophets from, in one occasion, Stephen does the same thing, pointing to the rejection of God's messengers over and over. So that's one aspect. What else? And so they've despised the kindness of the Lord, as Paul would say. What else? Right. And so that no remedy is Brother Waldron picks up on that phrase. I appreciate that phrase. There's just nothing else to do. There was no coming back from where they had gone to. And we've been noting that for a while. What are some of the other particular things, Brad? Yes. And as far as following the sins of the other nation, going back to the beginning of Israel and the law, what is the emphasis of the law concerning the other nations? Right. Don't be like them. Don't have anything to do with them. And even descriptions of here's what they are like. Here are the types of things that they do. And listing those out sometimes in increasing severity, saying, stay away from these people. So understand what, as Brad said, what's encapsulated in that they followed after the sins of the other nations. That's specifically the thing that they were not supposed to do. But when you begin to look at the other nations that were surrounding them, it can be horrifying. And they participated in those horrors. And as Brad said, top to bottom, right? This is not just the elite participating in this. This is the whole of the nation. All right. One other thing that I notice here that may give some irony to some things we've read earlier about how they treated the Lord, how they treated his property. They defiled the house of the Lord. Why is that ironic based on some of the other things Jeremiah has said? What was the cry of these people? The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. You mean the one that you are defiling, the one that you are, mocking by your behavior, that you are considering a common thing. And then when you want it, when you need it, then you hold it up and say, but we've got the temple. I mean, the thing you don't care about, that you don't pay any reverence to, and yet you're going to hold that up as the thing that's going to save you. So I think there's some irony there in that being listed out here at the end among the things that they had done. They defiled the very thing that they pointed to as their hope. And so that puts it in contrast there, stark contrast. All right. Right. Well, yes. And let me suggest something there that I think sometimes when we see somebody who's weak like this, he stiffened his neck against doing what's right. But I don't know, I would say that a lot of people who are cowards, who know what the right thing to do is, their cowardice is what causes them to stiffen their neck against doing the right thing. Like, I don't take ever Zedekiah as being a strong guy. I take him as somebody who will follow what the people around him are doing. And we'll lean in those directions. And so in that way, because he followed them, then he stiffened his neck. So that phrase doesn't, I think it does point to Zedekiah's guilt and so forth. His vacillating, though, that's evidence of his stiffening his neck. You know, I think that's part of his, no, I'm not going to do that. You know, the one person you'll take a stand against is Jeremiah. And it's because of all these other people. Because this is not a strong man. This is not a man who has any conviction about him, except that he wants to see Jerusalem. He wants to stay on the throne. That's what he wants to do. And so what a sad commentary on him and his end as the king of Jerusalem. Well, as the city falls, Gedaliah comes into play. And who is Gedaliah and what position does he hold? Okay, he's appointed governor, not king, governor. And incidentally, as we continue on through the history, that will be the leadership. It will be governors, not kings anymore. What else? Who else is he? We got a little bit of genealogy there given. Who's he the son of? All right, Shaphan. Does anybody remember who Shaphan is? If we go back to Josiah, He is one of those nobles that when they find the law, he goes over there to Huldah the priestess. And so he's among Josiah's inner circle there and part of the reforms that are taking place. And so he's of the lineage of those that are there with Josiah at the last time Israel was worth anything, or Judah rather was worth anything, was moving in the right direction. So maybe there's some hopefulness given in that, that they've appointed, that Gedaliah has been appointed, and he's someone who's got some lineage that would point maybe in a good direction. Alas, what happens to him? All right, so this, and what's his name? Ishmael. And so a man named Ishmael comes in. I wonder about a Jew naming their kid Ishmael. That is interesting to me. You know, they place a lot of emphasis on names, and you go name your kid that with the history of who Ishmael is. But nevertheless, so he comes in, he takes these 10 men, and it's treacherous. He kills him. He kills these representatives even of the Chaldeans. And then where does he run with the people that are left? Where do they go? Yeah, they head up to Ammon, and they get away. There are some who come back. Now, understand most likely what's happened here. These warriors who are coming back into Judah are probably people that fled during the siege, and now they're coming back to Jerusalem. And so they come back and they pursue him. They don't catch him. What position does that leave the people in who are left? Yeah. Right. It's Babylon. And so they're going to come down and you've killed Babylonians. And so there will be no mercy is the mindset here. And I mean, they're not wrong. I mean, they're not foolish for thinking in that way, that Babylon would show. And here, as Brad says, they're at the scene of the crime, that the blood's right there. And what have you done? And, well, the guy ran off. Sure he did. And if they even get a chance to give that explanation. So I think we can at least appreciate the motivations that say, we got to get out of here. But they do appeal to Jeremiah. And what is their appeal? I mean, what do they say to Jeremiah when they appeal? Yeah. Isn't it heartbreaking that they have to start off that way? Just say what you mean. Why don't you just say, listen, Jeremiah, tell us what God says. If we like it, we'll do it. If we don't, we're going to do what we want to anyway. But they don't say that. They come with noble words, noble, and I think to some degree people can fool themselves into having the actual intentions. You say, I'm going to do whatever God says, and then you drop the bomb. God says, stay here. In the face of the possibility that Babylon is coming down. But it's not just stay here and you don't know what's going to happen. What assurance does Jeremiah give them? Yeah, now that's pretty tough not worrying about the king of Babylon, isn't it? That's king of the world. Don't worry about him. It's no big deal. God's on your side. It shouldn't be tough if you trust God. Brad? Yeah. Yeah, that plant and not pluck up. Pluck up's what he's just done. And he's saying, I'll start over. We'll plant you right here and we'll begin again and we'll start to rebuild. And it is a tremendous assurance. And yet they've just seen their governor slain. Before that, they've just seen their city destroyed. Really, though, that's all the more reason to trust God, especially the city being destroyed, because that is God keeping his promises. That's not a failure on God's part. That is assurance on God's part. I will do what I say. So they had opportunity and good reason to trust God, but they do not. And yes. Yeah. And what is... What does this mean that God repented of the judgment of the calamity? Yeah. Yeah. I think it's the same word you find God repented that he'd made man on the earth. It's translated in a lot of places, sorrow. So God takes no delight in what he just saw and what he just helped cause, brought about. It's not like he's saying, Oh boy, that was satisfying. He said, and I don't want it now. I don't want to crush you even now. I would still, as Michael said, even now, if I could just get a couple of people who will listen to me, I'll build you back up. And so I think, again, to see, you know, people, again, that they're so constantly looking back at the Old Testament and pointing to the wrathful God of the Old Testament. This is the wrathful God of the Old Testament. The one who says, I did not want to do this. And even now, I don't want to continue it. I would stop it right here if you would just let me. Stan? Right. Yeah, you don't believe it, frankly. Yeah. Yeah, you begin to understand, and even yet, then we don't appreciate how much it hurts God. And he is. He sorrows over that. And so the reason I point out the mercy is because I think we need to see how thoroughly God's mercy is illustrated through these periods of judgment that we think are only, not necessarily we, but people think are only illustrations of his wrath. Right there, is his mercy displayed again. All right, we'll pick up there, finish up the question, and then move on into, some other parts of Jeremiah and Daniel in our next lesson. Appreciate your good attention.